we'd like to express our appreciation to each one of you for your coming. I'd also like to point out that both Dr. L. Dorea and Brother Hutto have agreed to the publication of this discussion in book form, and we're certainly hoping that it will materialize and that in the near future there will be available for all who desired a copy of this discussion in book form. And we're going to have a question period again this evening, as we've had each evening. We're going to give each person who might need to leave the building, though, at this time.
Let me say something for you.
All right.
I don't want to make a speech, but I do want to say that I appreciate very much the very fine conduct on the part of the audience, and also the very splendid deportment of Dr. L. Dorea. And I want to get the opportunity of asking him the first question. And before you leave, I want to tell you what it is. Because so many of you have been curious, because I've been curious. I have wondered, and I do not mean this, except I want to find out. I'd like to know what the different robes and the turban and all that stand for. Lots of people have asked me, and I don't have any idea, and I hope you'll tell us.
First of all, I really wish to sincerely thank you for your patience and endurance. I think we have contributed to your understanding and to our affectionate love to each other, which I believe will be the outcome of this. The important thing is to pursue knowledge of God, not to say, my goodness, my preacher told me now we have it good and so forth, forget about the Quran. Or I say, my goodness, I read about the Bible and so forth, and I should just close the book on it. That will be really doing our God injustice. We must continue this. We want you to be in touch with us. But as we read your New and Old Testament, we also ask you to kindly take time out and try to read the Quran. Because I guarantee you, none of these so-called unrealistic aspects exist in it. You see, Muhammad lived to actually establish a city-state, a government, a code of life, a way of life, and a totality of laws that can govern man, from marriage, from inheritance, and what have you. Which shows this is part of what Jesus was talking about. When he comes, he's going to show you things to come. You'll find all of this. I'm not going to have to rehash things with you. But the idea is this. We revere Jesus very highly for what God made him. When we talk about, you know, Jesus the Son of Man, or Jesus the Son of God, as sometimes written and so forth, read again for yourselves. Study again for yourselves. And by all means, as Brother Hutto tells you, try to get the Gospel of St. Barnabas. He was one of the associates of Jesus. And read it. We were very interested to read it simply because we're trying to find origin. Not because it supports, as the claim makes, supports our claim. We don't need that kind of support. Jesus himself, God bless him, supported our claim. And I am sure as we continue this kind of give and take without closing the book on it, we can benefit. But if we go back as we are, feeling pitiful again towards each other because, my God, they haven't been led to the right path or things like this, we would be making a horrible mistake to ourselves and the intellect of our future generations that will live with each other. Just forget about what's happening. And you try to be the ones who will raise the next generation in terms of brotherhood and love and affection. We don't get offended when somebody says, oh, you blasphemous people, we don't need your Quran. No, we don't. We know for a fact this is natural. We may have felt the same way before we learned about you and some of the beautiful teachings that Jesus has taught. After all, when you teach things about how to behave in life, and we find that they're very similar to what we have learned throughout our life. After all, Jesus came from our people. Remember, those who followed Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad were essentially the same people. And this is why that continuity may tell our leadership in the future something about how to live better with mankind. the end of wars, the end of conflicts, the accommodation of each other, the tolerance. Love thy neighbor, even if thy neighbor is across the Atlantic. Thank you very kindly. The robe is basically so that when my brother Hato is cold, I can get him inside. It is basically, you see, I consider you, my brother, that means you are my tent. In the winter, it's true, it's to keep you warm. In the summer, it's to keep the heat away by building an insulation around you. So you are like me. When you feel cold or hot, cold I take you, in hot I tell you, please, go under the shade of the tree. It'll be too hot. But the dress is essentially a predominant dress that you may see in the among the portions of the population whom you would call religious or conservative in their living. There is no specific significance in it, except we just want it to look presentable to you and make us interesting as we talk to you, so that you don't get bored. Yeah, the turban is definitely worn by students who study religion, and whether it's Al-Azhar University, as my friend asked, or by sheikhs who become experts, or like Brother Hato, you know, learn people in religion. I am not. I happen to have graduated from Cairo University and came here and became a zoologist, then a pharmacologist. I am now currently engaged in cancer chemotherapy. That tells you an awful lot how much I believe in and how much I love both Jesus and Muhammad, because it is my basic life to learn as I go through the main things that I have to earn my living through. I do not earn my living by preaching. I'm not a preacher. I'm just simply a guy who likes to get to understand others and understand others and others to understand how we feel towards you. You are people of the book, our cousins, our brothers. And the more we try to understand each other, and the only way is through this give and take. We cannot just continue to be away from each other. You have a good radio program. Once in a while, invite some Muslims to come and talk with you.
I'd like to. I'd like to encourage more of this type of discussions. And obviously, Dr. Eldorea would like to have more, so I'm confident that if both sides desire more discussions of this nature, there will be more of such discussions in the future. And any time, incidentally, that you're in the radio audience, you call in. If you've got a telephone, ask Brother Hato whatever you want to.
How can I get him to ask me?
Get your own brother.
Sir, I'd like to ask one thing, Mr. Pastor. It's very important for any nominating relation in here. Really, I don't understand. They said, you know, that Jesus, you know, here died for our sin.
If I may, just for one moment, listen.
Yeah. I'd like to
let's
hear Father Muslim nominating because we're
right,
confused about the case.
All right.
We'd like him to explain.
Just a moment. We're going to allow those who need to leave to leave because we have been here a long time, but we'd like to encourage all who can stay and would like to stay with us, and we will discuss your question. So if anyone needs to leave, just feel free to do so. But do so very quickly. Please. We're going to give each man here an opportunity to ask questions at least for the next 15 or 20 minutes. and we're going to allow each one of the men on the platform to respond to any question that may be asked. And we're going to begin by letting the gentleman here on the front repeat his question.
Okay, sir. Really, you know, I've been here 2 minutes now. I respect, you know, all the preachers, people that are good people and bad people, good wisdom and bad wisdom. And you all know that. I love God very much. I give my life for it. But I'd like to know why did God, He created us, why He is going to punish Himself? You know, He created us. He gave us the brain for the talent. He gave us the book to obey. Anybody obey, get to a work. If you work, if you go to university, you graduate, you make some money. If you don't, you know you don't make. Meaning, if you are good, the God give you a work. Why He is going to, on the cross, in miserable, you know, to get punishment, and I'm no good, you know, I kill the people, I steal, I do lots of dirty thing, you know, still I'm going to go to heaven. I don't understand.
Well, I wouldn't claim to understand all there is about it. All a part of what I'd say about it is a matter of this is what is revealed, and there is a good bit of information given about it. I think one of the best ways, it seems to me, to look at it right now is in a day when we find crime just running wild and all sorts of illegal activities just seeming to prosper. And one of the reasons that it seems to me that that's taking place is because our courts and other things are taking a very light look at crime and just saying, well, that wasn't too bad. Maybe you killed a fella. Maybe you robbed the bank, but maybe you'll do better. And for that reason, we have crime. What I'm saying is, when you have the idea that crime is really not all that bad and really doesn't deserve much in the way of punishment, the kind of thing you're going to have is anarchy. But when we look at what the Bible presents about sin, and who is man to say just how, when you think about what is involved in transgressing the law of a holy God, then you begin to think about something about sin, but who is man to say what is the right payment for sin? For example, say that you do me some injustice, and I want to repay you. Well, I may be too hard on you, or I may not be easy enough on you. But when it comes to the matter of God, God's going to be fair about it, and He knows what the right answer to that is. And the answer that God gave is that sin requires punishment. That's something that you can just find anywhere you'd look. Sin requires punishment. It does in the courts of the land. A fellow commits a crime, he ought to be punished for it. Well, though, instead of God punishing us, He is showing to us the tremendous love that He has for us. That He wants us to be a different kind of person. That He wants us to be a different kind of people. And so, as I suggested earlier, rather than just saying, do better, God chooses rather to punish sin, but He is willing to send His Son to die for us. And saying, all right, here is my Son, reverence Him, I'm willing to let Him die. That allows sin, to begin with, that allows the justice of God to be upheld. God's not going to let people get an easy outlook on sin. It's going to let God's righteousness be upheld. It's going to let people see that sin is a real tragedy that would require such an act. But not only does it say that, it shows the love of God. Not only is God just, but God is love, and He is willing, as we said earlier, to share with us the struggle. Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. And thereby was able to become a perfect sacrifice for our sin. So He was willing to die in our place. We ought to have died, but by this glorious display of love, He died for us. So that if we'll put our confidence and trust in Him, God is willing to forgive our sins on that basis.
Am I going to heaven or hell? I'm no good.
Okay. All right. Of course, that depends. When you say, am I going to heaven or hell if I'm no good? Since a man has sinned, violated God's law, become just a regular outlaw, if he is willing to recognize the enormity of his sin by seeing what Jesus did for him And he is willing to put his faith in that sacrifice that Jesus made. God is willing to forgive his sins on that basis. That doesn't mean God forgives his sins way off out yon in the future. It does mean God forgives his sins that he's committed up till then. But the blood that Jesus shed is not only effective for those sins, but later, if after you have become a Christian, if later you sin, you can still appeal to God by virtue of the blood that Jesus shed. If you'll turn through him in penitence, God will forgive. So what I'm saying is, if you become a Christian, that does not mean that, well, I've already believed in Christ and therefore I can be a bank robber and I'll go to heaven. No, the Bible teaches you've got to be faithful to the commitment that you make to Christ when you become a Christian. Because when you become a Christian, you're committing your life to Jesus Christ. And you've got to be faithful to that, and if you renounce that, well, no, you're not going to heaven. You'll have to be faithful in your living for Christ. Does that answer?
Yes, sir. I heard some Christians say, we are Christians. Is there anything we do, we will not go to hell. So, actually, is there anything?
Now, they were Baptists. No, seriously, and I'm just... Seriously, that's not what the Bible teaches. And if that's what they think it teaches, that's not right.
Well, there is one thing, Mr. Hartley, is very important today for translation, for understanding, you know, the meaning, you know, what you're saying now. Some people, you know, they don't have enough education, not enough the brain. They think they can kill the people, they can't steal anything, that the name is about Christian. Anyway, you know, that Jesus, he died for us, we will be forgiven. I could do anything I wanted to because I'm not going to punish.
No, that wouldn't be right.
Physically, is the law in the United States all over the world is the physical applied technology of the God, what he ordered to us. He said, do this, don't do this. He gave orders, Adam and Eve. He said, you did this, you did this, you did this. If you love me, you obey me, not to this. This is the law.
That's right. If a man loves God, Jesus.
Jesus, he said, God, he said, you eat this, don't eat the pea for the pork. And for if you love me, it's in our also relation, he said, if you love me for my sake, don't drink. We don't drink. I know you don't drink too. But some other nominating, you know, for the religion, they do drink, they don't believe.
I know of some Muslims that drink.
One day I was in the meeting, you know, some meeting. There was one preacher, I'm not going to say what preacher was it. After meeting finished, and they give some drink. Oh boy, I was looking for it. I turned my face, I was new to this country. I said, you preacher, you can drink? He said, what is wrong with it? I ran away from this place.
I don't blame you, I would too.
Yes. I would like just to comment on the fact that there is a development of this doctrine of atonement. Really, it is based on developing the idea of sonship. That was, when you develop the notion that Jesus is the Son of God, then you have to justify something very unusual about him, especially in the light of what seemed to have happened to many of the so-called eyewitnesses. And with eyewitnesses, I will come back, I would like to say something about it. The fact that Jesus himself in so many verses calls himself, I am the Son of Man. The fact that he refers to, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, a grievous man who is feeling pain, if he was the one who was on the cross. All of these are designed to build a concept that was typical of what is existing in the Greco-Roman area. You had to have a son of God, a representative of God like this on our earth. And therefore, the theory of atonement declaring that God had to receive the shedding of blood, and in this case, because he came from a virgin birth and hasn't made any sins, to receive that pure shedding of blood, a shedding of pure blood to atone for mankind's sin. It's a very unjust doctrine in the eyes of Islam. I know a lot of Christians in different denominations believe in that. But it just seems very unjust that God would require
a man, whether he call him son of God or not, to carry the burden of the rest of mankind, knowing for a fact that the basic teaching that you can all find in the New Testament and the Old Testament and in the Quran, there is the continuity of the true meaning of how to reach God through repentance and doing right, living right with yourself, with your fellow man, and with your God. But just simply to accept a doctrine of atonement in itself is not going to rescue us from our bad deeds if we do that. This is what I wanted to comment. Therefore, I want to go back to the idea of eyewitness. I never for a moment disputed that there were eyewitnesses. What we have been disputing is those who related to us what the eyewitnesses have conveyed to us. This is what we have always been talking about in the four nights. The reliability of the documents from which we learn who was an eyewitness and what did the eyewitness hear and relate to us in its exact original form. Like Barnabas, they say this gospel, you know, the original of it was found on his body. And the man lived with Jesus. And here we come and we find things in it. Some things are inconsistency with a great deal that is there in the New Testament. Some is very much inconsistency with what we find in the Quran. Some is very nice and humane for mankind that can never change in terms of God's love to mankind. But we also find in it something that is hard to believe in view of the old prophecies, their realizations, and the new prophecies. This is where we must continue to search for the truth. This is where we want to find the real eyewitnesses' testimony, not what is purported as testimony of eyewitnesses. Thank you.
Let's let Mr. Vickery ask a question. Maybe the deeper those fellow. I'd like to see him ask somebody else a question.
All right, let me say just a moment. I am going to restrict, though, these gentlemen on platform to 3 minutes, whether they like it or not.
Oh, don't worry about that. That's my brother, I told him. My goodness, he doesn't have to worry about that. You want 5, 10, take it.
The question I would like to ask has kind of two or three parts to it, but it is one question, really. I believe you recognize Jesus as a prophet.
Are you addressing a question to Dr. Elder Rick? All right.
Yes.
All right. You and Mohammed is a prophet.
Yes.
His writings or his message is preserved eternally, and yet God's other prophet, his is not preserved. Now, that seems a little inconsistent, that God could not preserve Moses. Now, this is not all. Now, I understand that Mohammed came on the scene about 600 years ago.
600 A.D.
The people of the world were in total confusion. History testifies to this. That's answering your last question first. Even the Christian dictionary, in terms of the history of the church, testifies to the fact that there was an awful lot of bickering and turmoil and killing in the name of this doctrine is better than this, this disagrees with that. Yeah, history is full of this. That is true. But on the other hand, the very close associates of Jesus continued to follow his very true teachings. And we know also from our readings that there were rifts among them. And this is what we call, you know, those who have received the Holy Ghost to guide them to speak with one accord. Apparently this has not succeeded, because we do know there are differences. There were differences between them. Now I'll come back to your first question and answer them as we go. I think, what was your first question again, so we can go at them one by one?
Well, the thing you said that the Quran would be preserved in print.
Yes.
Now,
okay.
Yes. Would God be that inconsistent? He cannot preserve the pure
Oh,
that's all.
I understand. It is true that God, throughout the ages, sent prophets and messengers to people in their own communities. There probably are many, many of them. I couldn't recount them all to you. I cannot remember all of the names. But it's also true, as man was evolving, his only method of transmitting that revealed truth was only by oral tradition. Now, it is also true that the preservation, once man has started learning how to write, he did his best to write down that which he thinks he should preserve dearly to him. During the lifetime of Jesus, there must have been writers who recorded his sayings. But you see, God had a plan. And that plan is God's own design. He teaches and guides mankind on stages. For example, if God has preserved the original scripture from the time of Abraham, we probably, if God willed it to be that way, we probably have had it, and that's it for us. Wonderful, beautiful. This is attested to by the fact that Moses always referred to that, and Jesus always referred to Abraham. And Muhammad always referred to Jesus. In other words, everyone that came referred to the scriptures before and reaffirmed what's right in it. Jesus reaffirmed what was right prior to his coming. And he tries to stress it in spite of what they were trying to apply. And this is why it was God's design that eventually and gradually, through man who believed only in miracles, the age of miracles should come to an end when man receives the final instruction. Therefore, all miracles ended with the coming of the Prophet Muhammad. And therefore, the preservation of the scripture was commanded by God from that on with a promise that no more he will leave mankind in turmoil like this.
The other night I raised this very point when I said the idea that the scriptures were corrupted is out of harmony with the nature of God, because he said, "My word shall not pass away, they'll endure forever," and on that basis we would have the word of God passing away. It would be out of existence as far as man is concerned for at least 600 years. As a matter of fact, the only manuscripts we know anything, or the only teaching we know anything at all about Moses, are the manuscripts we now have. So what I'm suggesting is, we not only for 600 years had no word from God, but what would it amount to? There would have been no word from Moses or God from Moses all up till the coming of Christ, which really means that people on earth just did not have any word from God, period, until Mohammed came. But he says very clearly, the word of the Lord endures forever. And so I cannot believe the idea that right after he gave the gospel, it just got so corrupted that men were without it for 600 years. If God could protect the gospel, quote, given through Muhammad, he could through Jesus, he could through Moses, and I believe he did.
The gentleman here in the door to the back.
If I understood you right, you reject the idea of blood atonement. Yet, for whatever reason might be given, are you not commanded to keep animal sacrifices by the Torah?
The only command is not obligatory except in memory of the obedience of Abraham when he was commanded to sacrifice his only son as ordered by God, and he was willing to do so. Then when God accepted a sheep to be sacrificed, it's in memory of this. And the sacrifice here has two reasons. First, in memory of this occasion, and second, since you do the sacrifice, if you are able, then you distribute it to the poor. It is always an act of mercy. It is not an act of any kind of paganism. For example, my brother Hato has referred many times about the idea of the black stone. People kiss it. That is not part of worship. It is not part of the pilgrimage. This is part of an affectionate thing that just happens to be by whoever wants to kiss a stone that was very cherished. But it is not part of the worship at all. The going around, they go, for example, seven times. That commemorates the time when Hagar was ordered
to leave Abraham's house. You know the story, we cast out that bondwoman and so forth, and she was in search of water for her son. But nothing more, nothing less. The whole idea, for example, of pilgrimage to Mecca signifies the unity of the message coming back to the first house of God that was built by Abraham, and the unity of mankind because of brotherhood, and the unity of the message that is being fulfilled at least once in a lifetime in terms of pilgrimage, where people from all corners of the world could gather in remembrance of the one God. In other words, the whole theme is very clear from the time of Adam. The oneness of God, worship none other than Him, and obey His commands.
All right.
Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Elderier. He was talking about Acts, the 15th chapter. He said here that, starting out in the first verse, how that people came from Judea to Antioch where Paul and Barnabas were, and talking about the circumcision. And you quoted verse 2, when therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension with and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. From my understanding of what you said, you left the idea that Paul and Barnabas were on opposite sides of this question. And my main point is, you were talking about men who were the essentially the original disciples of Christ, ones who were with Him physically. Well, here in the latter part of the 15th chapter, we have the reply of Peter and of James, who was undisputedly one of the so-called original disciples of Christ, who was with Him through His ministry. He says in verse, I believe, 24, this is James speaking, for as much as we have heard that certain which went out from us have troubled you with words, subverting your soul, saying, you must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandments. Now, to me, this seems like it's saying that the apostles and elders at Jerusalem did not give this command. From what Peter said earlier in the chapter, this was not a command binding upon the Gentiles. And it seemed to me the impression that you were saying this was. I'd like to have your comment.
As far as the parting and each one going his way, that historically is true. As far as the instructions as to what to do about the Gentiles, it is true that they did have quite a bit of discussion about it. And they had to recall them and have a special meeting by the original contemporaries of Jesus to decide on this. And it was Paul's predominant idea that eventually got hold. The point in all of this is the fact that, and you said it right, but in a camouflaged fashion, if you excuse the expression, you said Paul and Barnabas were essentially disciples. The fact is, Barnabas was a definite associate of Jesus. Paul was not. And as a matter of fact, Paul, according to what I have read, has not had that vision until quite a while after he had persecuted many Christians. And for some reason he wanted to go to Jerusalem and see Jesus or something like this, and somehow outside of the city, and he had somebody with him, he fell down and claimed to have had a vision. But there is no authority to tell us that he saw or spoke to Jesus until Jesus has been arisen to heaven.
Of course, the discussion here came up about whether or not people were to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. And Paul not only is described here, but also in Galatians, the second chapter, as being very much opposed to it. As a matter of fact, it took a revelation from God to get him to go. But when he got there, they were all of the same mind. Not only Paul, but Peter and James and all the rest, There was no dissension among the apostles as to what was to be done, and that is that the Gentiles were not to keep the law of Moses, nor were they to be circumcised. So, I mean, there was complete agreement on that. We could comment about whether or not Jesus really saw the Lord. He claimed he did, claimed he talked with him, and on that basis became a preacher that was willing to give his life for what he saw, not for what he felt, not for his opinions, not for Hellenistic influences, but what he saw with his own eyes. And on that basis, he was willing to not only preach, but sacrifice, which argues for his honesty.
All right, the gentleman here on the front row.
In the Muslim temples on Mount Moriah, and also in one in Egypt, why do they pull their shoes off and have them pull their shoes off and put their little canvas shoe on? And why is not any seat inside?
Oh,
chair.
Yeah, any place of prayer that is traditionally an individual who is going to go to any place of prayer must take off his shoes, because you do not pray with your shoes on, and you do not pray except on the ground covered with something clean. You have to have a place that is clean because of the fact that you bow and you prostrate yourself to God in terms of total submission during the time that you assume to be in the presence of Almighty God. So it's in complete reverence the individual has to be while he is with God.
What about the wash? They wash your hands.
Yeah, the ablution. The ablution is symbolic of cleanliness that not only is required every time before you pray, so long as you have not endured any of what breaks the ablution, but it's also that you are always coming to God in a clean fashion, so it reminds you with the idea of cleansing yourself. In other words, the devotion of prayer is essentially a remembrance to a person who involves himself in it that he is meeting his God morning, noon, afternoon, sunset, and evening, constantly reminding himself with the fact that he is always in contact with God in spite of what he does all day long. And beautifully enough, in Islam, your work from which you earn your money is a form of prayer, a form of worship, because you are doing that which God requires you to be able to sustain yourself. Thank you.
All right, I believe the gentleman right on the back row. Speak louder, please.
Give me the page, please. Could you give me the page? What?
137.
Yes, sir. Yes.
The old God said, O Jesus, I will take thee and raise thee to myself, and clear thee of the falsehood of those who blaspheme. I will make those who follow thee superior to those who reject faith.
Yes.
The point I'm making is that here is a place that says that the followers of Jesus will be made superior. Can you tell me any place where it says that the followers of Muhammad superior?
Simply by following Jesus.
This is what it says. It says those who follow Jesus will be made superior. You have it in front.
I know.
Okay.
That's what I'm telling you. We are followers of Jesus. You not know. In the sense that you want us to be followers of him, but in the sense of what God wants us to follow him for. Jesus did not say, follow me as your God. He told us, follow me because I bring you the truth of God. And in this sense, Muslims do indeed feel that they are better Christians than those who profess Christianity. Thank you.
I don't recognize
that. Where'd that fellow go back there?
Oh. Yeah, the gentleman right over there. Hand up.
I would like to ask a question from Ahayu Hata. He mentioned in during the talk about the Ahmadinejad Qadiani. And since Dr. Azari being a Muslim, he denied that the Qadiani and the Ahmadinejad are not Muslim. I would like to know who they are and how they were evolved. If you could throw some light on this.
You mean about the Ahmadiyya? Yes.
That's the official copy, and no changes since the time of the prophet has happened, and no change can happen. It's the same in the whole world. So I would like to know what is the unofficial copy.
Well, now, all right. Maybe I used an unfortunate choice of words. I meant to say, if I didn't say, I should have said, that their translation differs from this translation.
The translation is not the Quran.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. I guess I used a bad choice of words. But if what you're saying is true, then before I can know whether or not I am approved of God, I will not only will have to learn Arabic, I'll have to be an expert in it. Because I'll have to know whether Mr. Yusuf Ali really translated this right. Because if something as precious as my obeying God is concerned, I don't want to take his word for it. I don't want to just say, well, he knows more about it than I do. I'll have to not only be a scholar in Arabic, I mean a one that can read Arabic, I'll have to be a scholar in it. A man will have to learn Arabic and be a scholar in it, or else he cannot find out exactly what God said if a translation is not accurate. You see what I'm saying? Therefore, there'd be no point in my preaching about the Quran to anybody that cannot understand Arabic. Because what I'd be telling was a translation, and it might not be right.
What I'm saying is, if there would be a Muslim who agreed with that the Qadianis are Muslims, you are referring to a sect which 800 Muslims or 800 million Muslims of the world, they deny it. And you prove they are Muslims. At least there should be one Muslim in the whole world who can claim that they are Muslims. And then we say, okay, their translation is okay.
This is precisely...
I'm not sure I understood what he said, and I'd like to get you to tell me.
Yeah. The whole point... Well, this is what I was going to answer. Yeah. The whole point in this is that a Muslim who knows the Arabic text can guide you as to what is the closest. You see, none of the translations would really give you the exact meaning of the Quran. None of them, but it will give you the spirit of it. But at least those who confirm to you that this is the best translation we know of and we stand by it, I think you can learn an awful lot of the Quran. And that is why when I gave you this copy as you ordered it, I selected this. There are many people here that came getting me, he said, it says the Quran in English.
I have one Ahmadiyya people, they got my name, I don't know where. They sent to me one Quran, and my wife was born and raised in this country. And she read it, and he said, Mustafa, this is not Quran. I think it was Quran. I didn't know nothing about the Ahmadiyya in our relation.
They even went as far as, believe me, and that's why the Islamic World Center from all Muslim countries, they have representatives, they went as far as rewriting the Quran in Arabic and making English translation next to it and trying to distribute it. And they were immediately, Islam said, once they know about it, immediately pointed out to the whole world. So long as that you have an original copy to verify things against it, which are in existence, and I'm inviting you all, someday you may have a chance. As a matter of fact, we're going to urge, although see they don't allow photography and things like this, it's a little bit difficult, but we are going to urge the Muslim countries to come up with a definite declaration as to where people can see at least pictures of the original documents
that they are so sacred. Remember, when you have something written in these old days, it's so valuable that you're afraid that it is. But if you have an identical copy of it that could be verified, which they have, that they can at least let scholars come into it because of its historical value, they always have these available. And they are available. That's the point. They are available. I know I have seen in glass casings preserved pieces of the leather and the stone and so forth and the pottery on which the very original writings of the Quran heard directly from the mouth of the Prophet recorded down. We do have these. I have seen them. And I'm sure many visitors to the Middle East must have seen all of these. Anybody who cared, for example, to go to Cairo and go to the Museum of Islamic History, which is right back to back to the Cairo main library, they find these things, and it's open to the public.
Well, I'm still back to the problem. Here is a man who is a member of the Ahmadiyya group. Here is a man who is not and has this translation. And he opens it up and said, see, there it is in the Arabic. Well, it doesn't look like anything to me. And over here in the translation, it says, I will cause thee to die a death, or I will cause thee to die. And the other one says, I will take thee. Now, how am I going to determine which one of you has accurately translated? I can't just say, I'll take your word for it. Why can't I say, I'll take his word for it?
You are very right. But if you love to know the truth, you ought to pursue it and find it. Yes, okay. That's the whole thing.
And then when
and
I
that's
get
what
all...
we're doing, my friend. You see, you have to remember we're not rejecting the New Testament or the Old Testament. We are rejecting what we believe is not true in it. And we are trying to pursue. The more we believe the original verses, the more we are happy. We are very happy. We are, believe me, we rejoice the day we know the true teachings of Jesus to us.
Of course, I can't say other than the translations I looked up. I have no reason to believe these fellows just concocted that. But, still wouldn't be able to learn it myself, but what I would say about that is this, and that is that when we go to men like Jeffrey, H.A.R. Gibb, men of that kind that write about it, they say definitely and positively that it is not in existence. The original does not exist. The nearest thing we have to it is fragments that are 200 years or 100 years removed from the Prophet. These men have investigated. They've tried to find them. They could care less, really, about just exactly what it teaches. They're glad to translate it accurately. But when they make the investigation, they say it's not there. We don't have the original. It's not in existence. The closest thing we have are mere fragments 100 years removed from the Prophet. And so I say they've tried to see the original. They can't find it.
Let me suggest this. If you have a question, if you have a question, please ask the question. Well, just ask the, what is your question, though? Wait just a minute. You're still not asking the question.
But I asked the question, but nobody is answering.
Well, ask the question, see.
I asked the question to throw some light on the Padianis and the Ahmed into that, and describe what Padianis and Ahmed mean. Is with reference to the official and unofficial caste. I want to the origin of Ahmed, who they are, where they are, because directly in the speech. And the audience would be.
Wait just a minute, though. Now, you see, you're starting again to make your arguments rather than just ask the question.
Well, I asked the question first.
He speaks very good English. Everyone understands. He can hear, you know, maybe he can. He's a doctor, PhD. Thomas is no any way, you know, his language, you know. He's a rabbi, you don't understand. One second. He born and raised in Fatima. And he knows who is this Ahmadiyyat, who is this, you know, whatever he said. I didn't even know it.
Yeah. Well, let me say something.
He knows more about Ahmadiyyat than me, and more than even most people. The reason he asked you, are you more efficient, you know,
no, what I was saying was that really he made the observation how the Ahmadiyya came up was this. That is that all of you people claim to go by the same Bible and yet you've got divisions. My reply was there are divisions among Muslims. There are the Ahmadiyya, which you refuse to recognize as faithful, loyal Muslims. And not only that, their translation differs from yours. Now, I have here the translation I bought from Dr. Elder Rear. And it makes this comment. The Ahmadiyya sect has been active in the field. That is, the field of translating the Quran. It's Qadian, and I'm not pronouncing it properly. Published a version in 1915. Apparently no more was published. It's Lahore Anjuman has published Malvi Muhammad Ali's translation, which is passed through more than one edition. It is a scholarly work, and that's what I've got. It is a scholarly work and is equipped with adequate explanatory matter in the notes and the preface and a fairly full index. But the English of the text is decidedly weak. Now, that just says it's weak. It does not say that it's all that bad. So what I'm saying is the man who translated this commented on the Ahmadiyya version and says it is a scholarly work. Though the English of it may not be as good as his, and naturally I guess he'd say that, but he does say the Ahmadiyya translation that I have a copy of is a scholarly work. And it prints the Arabic and the English right alongside each other.
I think the young lady
here. I'd like to say one word, if I may, about the young lady. In view of the fact that I respect the teachings of the Apostle Paul, he says, let your women keep silence in the assemblies. And personally, I don't call them ladies in public assemblies. And I'd be violating my conscience if I were to do so. That's why I haven't called on the ladies.
May I do that on your behalf? I mean,
not on my behalf.
On my own behalf.
I think since...
Yeah, on my behalf, I'm not going to be...
As
whatever I'll do is always on my own behalf, not on his behalf.
But let me say this, though. In view of the fact that I am in charge of the question period, I believe that I ought to stay in charge of it.
You may give your question to a man, and the man will ask it.
And she wants to write a question down, hand it in to somebody.
Why the relation is on, you know...
No, we respect the teaching of the Apostle Paul along that line about women keeping silence in the assemblies as far as asking.
We respect that, sir.
And so that's the reason.
We do the same thing in the Islamic religion. In the same, you know, line with the lady, we can be safe.
Well, that's fine.
Same thing. We believe that too. But this is a free country, democratic country. Maybe you do have a good reason to be asking you that way. If you have, in your religion, we respect the people's religion.
All right. We'll let two more questions be asked. And then we'll bring it to a close. Let's see.
That's all right.
There's one back here in the back.
What about in the back? Clear in the back. That's all right. We'll get you next. Go ahead. No, you go right ahead, young man.
We have over 4,000 documents, manuscripts,
Well, if you are ever involved in research work, especially as a historian, you will know that the difficulty is immense because of the variety of writing. Therefore, I am just showing you an example of the fact that it was so difficult, it must have been very difficult, for anybody who wants to make a study has to find out which is which to really come up with something. It's lost in the process because so much has crept in, and so much that has crept in became repeated. And to many people, to many writers, to many copyists, they thought that even these are really original. So the original became mixed with some of the invented, the interpolations, the misinterpretations, the injections, the Hellenization, in other words, besides the misunderstanding of what has been in the original texts. This is what I'm referring to. And that is why it's very difficult for a scholar who wants to examine the manuscripts of the Old Testament to really find an easy job. In spite of this, there are scholars who did the job. And these are the scholars that I was quoting, who said that there are so many contradictory statements, so many intrusions from Hellenism. These are Christian scholars who are interested in searching for the truth. It's not Muslim scholars who said this. It's Christian scholars. And they are honest enough to record all of these for us to learn. And we are not learning to downgrade the teachings of Jesus, God forbid. We are learning to try to bring them into light, into focus. That is the idea.
I have to agree that the number of manuscripts lends evidence to support what we already have. As a matter of fact, to support what we have in the English translation. I believe it was Westcott and Hort who mentioned a number of manuscripts that we have and talked about some of the supposed mistakes. You'd be surprised what some of them are that people talk about. For example, here is one text that says the River Jordan. Another text won't say the River Jordan, it'll say the Jordan River. See, it's that kind of a... Sometimes it may be a matter of spelling. Like, is it S-A-V-I-O-R or is it S-A-V-I-O-U-R? Really a tremendous problem, isn't it? And the point that I'm making is, what these scholars are honest enough to admit is they call a thing like that a difference. He really boils it all down when he says that when you take out things like that that have no meaning at all, what you're left with is a text that really is accurate. And as a matter of fact, he said the only thing that could be any kind of a doubt at all about would be something on the order of 1/1000th. And then when he said you look into that, well, it just nearly gets down to nothing. So I'm suggesting the fact that we've got numbers of manuscripts with which we can compare. And really, I believe that the article I read in the Islamic Encyclopedia, the one by Jeffries, the one by others, they say that they have the same situation with the Quran if they would only face up to it, and they say that some of them are. And I've got that letter from that fellow in England that makes that claim. His name is Jones, I believe.
All right, the gentleman in the back, and this will be it. Speak louder, please.
The one original from which all other copies have been made. If you select Muslims who are allowed to enter the holy shrine, you have to remember this. This is what you call the holiest shrine for Muslims. You can entrust some of your Muslim brothers, and they will go in and come and testify to you. Or you can write to the Islamic Supreme Council. They are not. You don't think these people, believe me, they will not tell you anything but the truth. Try them, and you'll find out. But for you to be a non-Muslim, to be allowed to enter this, it says very clearly, وَلَا يَمْسَسْهُ إِلَّا الْمُطَهَّرُونَ. None shall touch it except the pure. Excuse me, I'm not inferring that you are impure.
But in the eyes of Islam, you would be, since you have not submitted to the will of God as Jesus taught it and as Muslims believe he taught it, not as you believe it. I know that. I'm not trying to be rude, but I'm just giving you why you will find difficulty if you are a non-Muslim.
Then the only objective for proof that I have is the word of a Muslim. That's okay.
As a matter of fact, yes, and you have these, a lot of Western scholars who have embraced Islam and went and saw it, they can testify to that to you.
I'd like
there are many writings to that.
I mean, after we're over, I'm going to get the names of
them. Yeah.
Western scholars that have seen it.
That what?
That have seen the original.
Yeah, there are publications of many. As a matter of fact, you have the copy of the Islamic Center?
Yes.
Yes.
No,
write to them. Yeah. And they may have obtained, as a matter of fact, pictures. And they may send you something like this.
Okay.
This will clarify the whole situation. There is a center in Washington. I'm sure I have seen a publication with you. They will supply you with this. I hope to God they have a picture so they can give it to all of mankind. It would be beautiful. I myself would love to see the original someday. And when I go to Mecca, I will make it a point. I have seen very early copies of it in the Cairo Museum. But I have not seen the Mus'haf as the one that was dictated, that was compiled. Yes.
I'm not out of order. Let me ask one more thing in regard to this. This was changed and developed a picture.
Beg your pardon? I beg your pardon?
Did a Muslim pay and develop a picture?
Can or did?
Did.
I don't know.
Say
I honestly don't know whether they did or not. I have to tell you what I know and what I don't know.
I really thought he said last night that I could get a charter flight,
yes,
and go over there and I could see the document.
Yeah, documents, some of the fragmentary things that I've
but
shown
I couldn't
you.
See the original Quran itself, the Uthmanic version.
You can declare, embrace Islam.
But I could not right now just charter a plane and go see it.
No, as a matter of fact, as you're in
as a matter of fact,
Mecca,
I couldn't.
Yes, you could not. As a non-Muslim, when you come to the outskirts of Mecca, they make it a point that, and they tell you from there on, if you are not a Muslim, you are not allowed to enter the holy shrine. It's a place that is very highly revered by Muslims, and it's very simple. I do not recommend that you try to conceal them because the penalty is very severe.
All I was saying was I thought last night you were saying I could. But now.
No, I was referring to some of the fragments that I saw in the Cairo Museum.
Okay.
And they are there, and definitely you can, as a matter of fact, they welcome you. And they can even take your camera and take pictures and come and show them.
Of course, I wouldn't know it if I saw it. I mean, I wouldn't know whether that's right or not.
Next time I go to Cairo, I shall take colored slides and bring them to you.